after Election Day. The extra votes could make a difference in several close contests where recent redistricting pits sitting Democratic Congress members against each other. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Writer, political commentator, and literary celebrity Gore Vidal has died. A prolific and distinguished author, Vidal wrote 25 novels. Many dealt with politics, sex, and American culture. Vidal had a sharp tongue to match his pen. Born into an upper-class family, he frequently denounced the wealthy and powerful, including many of his friends. His best-selling novels include Lincoln and Myra Breckinridge. Vidal's family said he died last evening at the age of 86. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from LifeLock, committed to protecting its members against identity theft. Details at lifelock.com/publicradio.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Enrico Moretti. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. And we will be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in a book that he's authored. The title of his book is The New Geography of Jobs. And it has recently been published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, so you can take a look at it if you're interested. And basically, he makes an argument kind of like this. He says that today there are three Americas in an economic sense. At one extreme, it's a place, and we're talking about cities, that have a very strong innovation sector, the places that are really booming. At the other end, there are the cities that were once dominated by traditional manufacturing. And in the middle, he says, there are cities that could go one way or another. And the key idea is here is that where you live, as much, maybe more, than who you are, will determine how successful you will be in the economy of tomorrow. And this is a very different argument from the one that we have been hearing about economic development for some time now. In this thing that they call the innovation economy, we had been told that geography really didn't matter. Where you lived didn't matter. Well, the argument that Professor Moretti makes is, in fact, geography does matter. He says it's more important than ever. And Professor Moretti, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Great.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. And I do think that this is, I right away when I looked at the book, I think I was interested in having a conversation just because this seems to me to be a rather different approach to this whole question of economic development and how do you get your city booming and perhaps how do you think about where you want to live. Let's start there because it does certainly seem that it is a shift from that kind of thinking that said, well, in this new kind of economy, that where you live didn't matter.
That's true. Commentators and pundits have been arguing that the world is flat. This was the Thomas Friedman book, probably one of the most influential books over the past 20 years on economy and globalization. People have been arguing that the world is flat, that geography doesn't matter, that because now we have email and Skype and the internet and cell phones, we can communicate very easily with each other. We can communicate with our coworkers. We can work remotely from wherever we are, wherever we want. We can telecommute. And so the place where we live doesn't really matter. But if you look at the data, this is not true. One of the predictions of the Thomas Friedman line of thinking was that the big innovation centers of America would disappear over time. There would be no reason for workers to be in Silicon Valley or in Boston or in Seattle or in Austin because they're expensive cities. They can live somewhere else and then call in and communicate via Skype and basically do the same job that they're doing now remotely. But the truth is that the opposite has been happening. The big innovation hubs of America have not lost jobs and investment. They actually have increased their share. So we see more and more concentration. And this is not an accident, but the inevitable result of powerful economic forces.
Mm-hmm. And I think also the argument that you make is that these places continue to be important. So like the cities that you've talked about, the Silicon Valley, the Austins, the Bostons, Ann Arbor is one that's on your list. I think Durham is one that's on your list. So these places, they continue to thrive and they continue to be magnets for people with high-end technical educations. But you also say that these places are places of growth kind of across the spectrum for employment because, you know, people are going to need the same kind of services there that people need anywhere. And in fact, if you're part of the service economy, your argument is that you're going to do better no matter what it is you do if you live in one of these cities.
Yeah, this is the most surprising and probably most important part of the story. I make a lot in the book about the rise of the innovation sector, but the average American will never work for Google or for Apple or for a biotech startup. But the rise of the innovation sector matters to all of us, including those of us who work outside iTech. And the reason is that every time a community is able to attract an innovative employer, an iTech employer, for example, it gains not just the jobs within that employer, but it also gains many more jobs outside iTech in the local service sectors. Occupations like waiters, carpenters, real estate agents, taxi drivers, as well as occupation that requires a lot of education, like doctors, lawyers, nurses, and teachers. I call this the multiplier effect. And this multiplier effect is surprisingly large. In my research, I find that for each new iTech job in a city, 5 additional jobs are created outside iTech in that city. So for example, take Apple. Apple has 13,000 workers in Cupertino here in Silicon Valley. But by my estimate, it supports 70,000 additional jobs outside Apple in local services in the region. So remarkably, this means that Apple's main impact on the local economy is not among iTech workers, is for workers outside iTech. And this is an important implication for policymakers. Today, if you're trying to generate jobs for the least fortunate of your residents, those who don't have a lot of education, probably the best thing that you can do is to attract innovative companies that hire a lot of highly educated workers.
Hmm. Something else that you argue that I think is also interesting, we have certainly all heard that people with college degrees make more money than people without. And so we can't dispute the value of the degree. But what's also striking is apparently that people with college degrees, college graduates, perhaps people with equivalent degrees, they will also do better if they live in one of these cities. That is, you know, if you live in a city, if you have a college graduate and you live in a city where there is a lot of college graduates, you'll do better than if you had lived in some place where there were fewer.
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. In 1980, an high school graduate in, say, Austin and in Flint were making roughly the same salary. In 1980, the two cities had roughly the same number of college graduates per capita. Today, the number of college graduates in Austin is 3 times larger than the number of college graduates in Flint. And today, an high school graduate in Austin makes almost twice as much as an high school graduate in Flint. And it's not that the worker in Austin is a better worker, works longer hours, or is smarter. It's the entire ecosystem of the city that has changed, and in particular the number of highly educated workers that surround that worker. In today's economy, a company's success depends more on than just the quality of its workers. It also depends on the entire ecosystem. And so cities that have a lot of college graduates tend to develop an innovation-based economy, And this brings even more college graduates attracted by those good jobs. And this further reinforces their edge. Mm-hmm. As you can see, it's a tipping point dynamic that makes those cities better and better places economically.
Now, I'm sure that when people would hear you make a comparison, say, between Austin and Flint, and the earning potential of people living in the two cities, I'm sure right away people are going to say, well, yes, but isn't the cost of living in Austin higher than it is in Flint? And is that going to eat into the advantage, the wage advantage of living in Austin as opposed to living in Flint?
It does. It does. To some extent, it does. An interesting aspect of the vitality of innovation centers like Austin, Boston, San Francisco, in Seattle is that the strength of their local economy reshapes not just the local labor market, but also the housing market. On one end, it creates jobs and raises salaries. On the other hand, it inevitably raises the cost of housing and therefore the overall cost of living. They're basically two sides of the same coin. So the ultimate effect on people really depends on whether they own or whether they rent. For homeowners, which is 65% of the American population, you know, they gain twice. One, because the salaries are higher, and second, because the value of their house, which is for most people is the main asset in their portfolio, has also appreciated. For renters, though, the benefit is more limited because the higher salaries, as you pointed out, are at least in part offset by the higher cost of living.
Let me introduce again our guest, then we have a caller we'll take. Enrico Moretti is professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley. His work has been featured in a number of places, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Slate, and he is the author of a book that lays out in greater depth and detail the kind of ideas that we're talking about here. The title of his book is The New Geography of Jobs. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the publisher. To a caller here, we have someone who is listening in Mattoon, and we'll go right there. This is our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very
sure.
Interesting program. Enjoy listening to it. I was of the mindset, I think much like what David said in his introduction, that the new technology was really, the resource was human beings, bright, innovative human beings, more so than any natural resource. And I think some of the cities pointed to that as a salvation. I'm thinking, you mentioned Flint, I'm thinking of places like Gary, Indiana, or Detroit, Michigan, so on and so forth. If a Silicon Valley, for some reason, would have set up in Detroit, you know, perhaps that whole area would be a much different place today. I'm thinking of Groupon setting up in Chicago. Actually, I think they're using the old Sears Roebuck warehouse on the west side. Now, the financial future of Groupon is still, the jury's still out on them. But geographically, I mean, obviously there's resources. I think there's maybe safety, how a person perceives their safety, and maybe opportunity, schools. Maybe that all plays a role, but what I'm getting from your guest's comment is it seems like those geographic areas currently under siege, they might stay that way forever or for a very, very long time if, in fact, your guest is correct. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I think you're raising two excellent points. The first point that is very solid is that location of innovative companies today doesn't really depend on natural resources or geographical feature of the landscape like it used to. You know, 100 years ago, the location of manufacturing firms did depend on easy access to transportation. There is a reason why Chicago, Detroit, and Cleveland, they all develop manufacturing clusters, and it has a lot to do with ship transportation along waterways. Today, it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's nothing specific, as you said, in Silicon Valley that would make it a cluster. There's no silicon in Silicon Valley. There's nothing that if you go to San Jose, which is the heart of Silicon Valley, there's nothing really particularly striking. Silicon Valley could have been born somewhere else. At the same time, the dynamic that we're seeing today seem to make the winners in this game stronger and stronger, and the losers weaker and weaker, because there's nothing specific about the geographical location of clusters. They're often seeded by random events. But once you start a cluster, that cluster start enjoying self-reinforcing forces where they have a lot of highly skilled workers in a certain sector and a lot of employers in that sector, and therefore they attract even more workers and even more employers. And so it's a self-reinforcing dynamic that makes them stronger and stronger. And I think it has profound implication for us as a nation, because these are forces that are lifting the locations that already have a lot of jobs and already have a lot of companies, but not helping the other locations. The second point that you were making that is excellent, the point about Groupon, I think it illustrates the point that I tried to make in the book, which is the innovation sector is not just about high tech. It's not just engineering and science, but it includes many other parts of the labor force that are making things that are unique and they add value. And I think Groupon is a great example. I mean, the Groupon innovation is not technological. There's nothing more than a website there. But it has it's a powerful idea that allows people to advertise locally where before they couldn't. And so it's a type of innovation that creates jobs, and I'm sure Chicago is benefiting from that. And, you know, time will tell whether it's sustainable. I agree with you. I'm not saying Groupon will succeed for sure, but it's a great example of an innovation that is not, you know, a technological breakthrough, but it's a good idea that generates value and ultimately local jobs.
All right. I thank the caller. We have a couple of others. Now we'll go next to Belgium. Line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I happen to have a interesting personal experiences that put me right in this situation, in that if I had a PG&E account in San Francisco, I could be a resident. I spend so much time out there. I have two children who live there. One's in the tech industry, another's in the music industry, and they live north and south of the park. So I spend a lot of time there, and I've noticed an interesting relationship between East Central Illinois and there, and that is the Champaign-Urbana area where Mr. Inge is located at. It's very, very well known for computer technology and stuff. And many things started there. Netscape started there as Mosaic, moved on out there. Google, some of the products that Google has comes from there, like Google Street Map started at the University of Illinois. It was an amazing thing to watch it as it grew all across the world, because it started pretty much right here in East Central Illinois. It was the first place, one of the very first areas where they had the map. And I spent, like I say, I spent a lot of time there. Here, it's very cheap to live. There, it's very nice to live. And it seems to suck people from these sort of areas where the technology sometimes starts and moves to these areas. Austin, and like you said, the Research Triangle. Many people come from Illinois and go to that place. You'd be absolutely surprised the number of Illinois alumni that scream and yell at the ball games they're on at these times. It's a huge number of people. And that, I think, is something that you probably haven't really addressed so much, is that the magnetic power of these nice places to live. Because if you notice the ones you talked about, with the possible exception of Ann Arbor, they all are very warm and nice, comfortable places, pleasant surroundings. That the initial people who went out there said, this is nice to live at, and then built the industry from that. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Again, it's another excellent point. One of the reasons why places like Silicon Valley or Seattle or Austin prosper is not that they have the residents that have the smartest with the highest IQ, but they're extremely successful at attracting smart residents from other places and attracting ideas from other places, whether from Urbana or from Israel or from Italy. Basically, the people who are innovating in Silicon Valley are rarely born here. They're from somewhere else. And a lot of the ideas, you're correct, they're not born necessarily here, but they are developed here. And this magnetic power, the part where I'm less I'm left with you is when you say that the magnetic power has to do with just the beauty of the area. I mean, obviously San Francisco is a great place to live. I live here and I like it. But there are many other places that are fantastic in America that haven't developed much of a thriving economy. Santa Barbara is probably even better than San Francisco. The climate is better. The surroundings are terrific. It has a great university, and it's just a sleepy economy that never really developed any high-tech or innovation job. Portland, it's also a great lifestyle, great surrounding, but outside Intel, the chips factory, that doesn't really have a lot of creative, innovative workers. So I do think that there is a lot about this magnetic power that you talk about, that clusters do attract great talent and great idea from elsewhere. But I think it reflects, it certainly good amenities help, and good weather and nice scenery help. But I think there is something deeper than that. It's not just natural beauty.
Well, here, and again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. This is definitely something that people here, and I'm sure a lot of other places, are thinking about. Here, as the caller said, we have a community where we have, here in Urbana-Champaign, a major research university. We have a lot of very smart people. We don't have oceans or mountains, but there are people who think it's a pretty nice place to live. And the question is, what do we do to really achieve what this place, given the human capital that we have, is capable of? What is the answer?
You know, college graduates are, among all American workers, are the most mobile group of all. They are constantly on the move. They are, half of them lives in a state different from where they were born. And they're much more mobile than high school graduates and high school dropouts. Communities like Urbana do a terrific job at creating high school college graduates. They're obviously major engine of production of human capital. But ultimately, college grads will go where the jobs are. They because of this high mobility, they are able to get, you know, to move to the areas that are the most thriving. And they end up going to where other college graduates are, in these magnetic innovation clusters where there is many innovative companies and many innovative workers like them. So it's the best that a community like Urbana can do, in my view, is to try to anchor a private sector in innovation that uses the proximity to the university, but it's ultimately independent of the university. It's not just paid for by, it's not, you know, outside university jobs. So what you need is private sector research and development jobs that could exploit the proximity to the university and would keep many of the brilliant college graduates that you guys train locally. That would start that self-reinforcing mechanism that then will lead to a cluster.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is here in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi there. Oh, I think last week you had someone on who was also talking about locating these clusters and what has to happen. And in both cases, I'm wondering what is going to be the upshot of the coming lack of water. Well, it's actually already here. And global warming, as far as impacts go, on what areas are going to be successful and what areas are not going to be. Mm-hmm. And I'll go ahead and just ring off, and thank you.
All right.
Well, environmental factors are certainly important. The lack of water is crucial, for example, in California. You know, if you look at how we use water today in the state, which has two or three of the key innovation hubs in the country, it's just wasted. It's super, super cheap for agricultural workers. I'm sorry, for the agricultural sector, which use a lot of it, sometimes very inefficiently, and very expensive for urban users who use not much of it, but much more efficiently. For example, if you go to the Central Valley, which is the agricultural part of the state, you'll see farmers watering not by dripping system, not by spraying systems, but just by letting the water run on the field. That's the least efficient way of watering, and that reflects the price that farmers pay. That it's way below its true value. By contrast, urban consumers in urban areas are facing much steeper prices, and they use water much more carefully in California. So in a case like this, I think there's a lot of room for using market mechanisms to realign incentives so that we all conserve resources in much more active ways.
Just going back for a moment to this question about how it is that you develop your city in a way that makes it attractive to these kind of people, these highly educated, innovative people that you want to have to make your economy boom. I think that in many places, and this is one of them, people have looked at some of the ideas of a man named Richard Florida, who has made the argument that says what you really want to do is make your city culturally rich. And that if you do that, people will think, well, that's a good place to live, and I will want to move there. You, I think, interestingly enough, make the argument that says, no, that's backwards. That in fact, people will go for the jobs, and that if you get enough critical mass of individuals there, they're going to demand those kind of amenities. But you can't get people to move there just based on those.
Yeah, so amenities certainly help, but I don't think they can be the only the driving factor for turning a community from a declining economy into a strong economy. In the book, I talk a lot about the experience of Seattle, in part because Florida highlights Seattle as an example of his theory. He points out to the fact that Seattle is so culturally interesting and vibrant, and it basically implies that Seattle had to become an high-tech cluster. The reality is that Seattle was struggling in the 70s. It had a very old manufacturing base. The one exception was Boeing. But in the 70s, Boeing was struggling, and so people were leaving the city by the thousands. And then the thing that turned the economy around was the decision of Microsoft to relocate from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Seattle. It was a very serendipitous decision. It didn't have to do with the culture of Seattle. It didn't have to do with the beautiful Puget Sound era. It simply had to do with the fact that Bill Gates' family was in Seattle, and he wanted to be near them. And that single decision basically was the starting point of the high-tech cluster in Seattle. And like if you look at it 20 years later, 30 years later, it was the single most important factor, because it was the seed, the magnetic force that later attracted all other companies and turned the city into the second largest software cluster in the world. Seattle today looks remarkably interesting, attractive, culturally vibrant, but it wasn't all that interesting, attractive in the 70s. It was only after Microsoft located there, the good jobs started locating there and growing there, that Seattle became that cosmopolitan, vibrant metropolis that we all know today. Just to give you, like in the late 70s, the situation was so bad in Seattle that at some point a sign went up on the freeway that said, "The last who leaves Seattle, please turn the light off." and so that was a symbol of a city in decline. In my view, amenities, culture, and a vibrant cultural scene are certainly important, and they're certainly important for residents, but I'm not sure they are the single decisive factor in turning around the local economy.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Enrico Moretti. He's professor of economics at UC Berkeley. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
I'm Wade Goodwin. Coming up on the next On Point, states push back on the implementation of the Obama health care law, rejecting the expansion of Medicaid. Plus, are the Olympics open only to those born with perfect physiques? Can you win gold without Missy Franklin's wingspan or Usain Bolt's height? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Tonight from 9 to 11 on AM 580.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Enrico Moretti. He is a professor of economics at University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of the book that lays out in much more detail than we can do here. It lays out some of the ideas that we are talking about. The title of his book is The New Geography of Jobs, and it is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We have another caller who's been patient here. We'll go to them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, excellent program. So actually, we have to pray for in Champaign-Urbana for the next Bill Gates to turn us around. I'm wondering, is there a second tier, or you also mentioned the ones that are, in other words, the up-and-coming ones in terms of places?
Yeah, basically, if you look at the map of the clusters, of the innovation clusters today, there are three or four that are large and have a variety of industry in it. Obviously, Silicon Valley is the largest of all. Seattle is also large. Boston is also large. These clusters have, you know, Silicon Valley will have IT, will have digital entertainment, will have biotech, will have a clean tech, more recently nanotech, new materials. It has a variety of industry and a variety of type of jobs. But then there is a large number of smaller clusters, you might call it second-tier clusters, but they're basically much more specialized, and they focus on one technology at a time. So Albany, New York has nanotech. Provo, Utah has software. Dallas has telecom. Raleigh-Durham is actually coming in between cases. I would call it the first tier. They're very specialized in life science, but it's a vast cluster that is growing. The clusters are not just all like Silicon Valley, but they come in smaller sizes too.
I hope that gets at the caller's question. Others, are, again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go to the other end, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you're making this argument that there are these, you can look at America as being kind of divided into three, with the places like the places we've been talking about, the Seattle, the Austin, the Bostons, Silicon Valley. These are the hubs of innovation. On the other end, then we have these places that had formerly been centers of manufacturing. And so that's places like Cleveland and Flint and Detroit, where the jobs have left, so the people have left, wages have fallen. They're not the places that people think about as being really desirable places to live. What will be their fate, and overall, what's the fate of manufacturing in America?
The last 2 years have been good for manufacturing jobs. There is a lot of talk among experts and pundits about the renaissance of American manufacturing. I'm much more skeptical about that, and the reason is that the last 2 years have been an exception. They've been preceded by 30 years of pretty continuous and steep losses. We have lost 370,000 blue-collar jobs per year for the past 30 years. And this occurred both during recession but also during better times. And it's driven by structural forces in the economy. One is globalization, and the two is mechanization. If you go to a factory today, you don't see almost any workers. It's all machines. American manufacturers are doing fine. They're actually producing twice as many goods in value as they were 30 years ago, but they need fewer and fewer workers. And the type of workers that they need is not what people have in mind when they're thinking about blue-collar jobs. The number of engineers in the sector has doubled at the time when the number of blue-collar positions has plummeted. And this reflects the diffusion of what in the book I call the iPhone-style supply chain. You know, the iPhone is, Apple is a manufacturing company, and Apple makes manufacturing goods. But basically, Apple has engineers and designers and marketers, they're all here in Cupertino, and they take care of the engineering phase, the innovation phase. But then the actual manufacturing of the product and the assembly takes place in Asia, mostly. And that same type of supply chain has become prevalent in most part of the manufacturing sector. So that's one reason why blue-collar jobs are plummeting. But well-educated positions, you know, positions for well-educated workers are actually increasing in manufacturing.
Over to Indiana for another caller. This is someone on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just got to say, listening to this, that as a person who grew up near Ann Arbor and who moved to West Central Indiana, the idea that location is a big part of a person's financial well-being is just so not news to me. But I think it's sort of the idea that where you live. Well, let's say the idea that a person who is successful and does well and then is very well rewarded. I guess that plays into the national lie almost that it's individuals that hold us all up. So we reward those people very well. So the wealthy now, the top 10% have 90% of the wealth in the country. It seems like this points out that we're kind of all in this together, and that we have built our country, and now we're in the process of sort of dismantling it by cutting all sorts of programs, cutting education and research. And it seems like the idea that being in a the right location says that we need to keep working to make sure that we have all this infrastructure that we've relied on. I guess I'm thinking back to the person you had on a few weeks ago talking about Mr. Zuckerberg and the fact that maybe he was just the person who came along at the right time to capitalize on the current innovations that are around, and if he hadn't been there, somebody else would have been. Mm-hmm. So if you'd just like to comment on that.
Yeah, so geography, you know, the idea that where you live matters is, I agree, is not new. There's always been a difference across American communities in their standard of living. There have always been more prosperous and less prosperous cities. What is new in the past 20 to 30 years is that these differences have increased dramatically. In the 80s and the 90s, the differences among American communities were not all that large. As I was saying earlier, Flint, Austin, and Raleigh were all paying sort of similar salaries. Today, Austin and Raleigh are paying almost twice salaries that are almost double the one that you see in Flint. And this gap keeps growing with every passing year. What's also new is that the forces that are driving these disparities across communities are not what they used to be. 60 years ago, the key predictor of a community economic success was physical capital, how much infrastructure they had, how much machinery they had. Workers in Detroit were particularly productive and well-paid because they had the best infrastructure and the best machinery in the world. Today, the best predictor of the community economic success is not physical capital, it's human capital, which means people education and their ingenuity. And so, you know, there have always been differences, and there will always be differences among communities, but the intensity and the forces that generate these differences are new, and I think we should definitely spend time trying to understand them, because it really matters for our, you know, for the future of our communities.
And just to take that point a little bit further, this point that that we have gone from the importance of physical capital to the importance of human capital, I think that was what, and that coupled with increases in information technology, that was what said, well, because of that, then people don't have to be in the same office. They don't even have to be in the same town. But I think you're also making an argument that says, well, actually, it is your ability to interact personally with other people really is very important. So what you want, not only do you want to have your human capital, but you'd like to have your human capital be able to talk to each other and do it in do it face to face, not, you know, being able to do it online as well. But there's a difference between that and getting everybody together in the same room.
Yeah, I think that's very true. New ideas and successful innovation are rarely born in isolation. My research shows that by being around smart people, we become smarter. We become more innovative and more productive. And so by clustering near each other, innovators foster each other's creative spirit and ultimately become more successful. Sure, we have, you know, email and cell phones and Skype and Internet, but even today, this face-to-face contact remains crucial. And this, I think, is one of the great paradoxes of our time. We live in a fully interconnected, globalized society, which is increasingly local, where location matters more than ever. Mm-hmm. I see it in my work when I try to do research, and you hear the same thing when you go and talk with people in, you know, in companies in Silicon Valley. I have a quote in the book. It's from a Israeli entrepreneur that moved his company from Israel to Silicon Valley, and he says, "Well, it might be an high-tech industry, but at the end of the day, this is still people's business."
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way that you put it, that we're living in a world that's increasingly global, but that it's also increasingly local.
It is. I think there are many paradoxes in our current state of affair in this country, but I think that's one of the most poignant, in my view.
Yeah.
We can get news from every corner of the world. We can learn about anything on any topic from Wikipedia and from the vast resources made available at our disposal by the Internet. And we can communicate at zero cost with any distant relative. And we do. But at the end of the day, the things that matter the most are the ones that we learn from people we interact face-to-face. Most of phone calls, most of Internet traffic is still heavily local. So it's a global economy. It's a global society, which is increasingly local.
I want to thank the last caller again. We just have about 5 minutes in this part of show with Enrico Moretti. He's a professor of economics from UC Berkeley, author of the book The New Geography of Jobs. Just something else that you talk about as well. We've talked a little bit about the economic divergence of these regions. Are there some other, do you think, significant ways that where other kinds of divergence, other than in terms of living standards, are going hand in hand with this other pattern that you're talking about, this economic pattern?
Yes, there are many. In fact, most aspects of our life are affected by this economic divergence. The economic differences between American communities have become so large now that they are now generating a growing divide in health, in politics, in community participation, in divorce rates. Let me give you just one example, health.
And one way you can measure health is by looking at longevity, how many years people live. The U.S. has vast disparities in longevity level that track fairly well the disparities in income and education across communities. The average man in Fairfax, Virginia, for example, lives 15 years longer than the average man in Baltimore County, just 60 miles away. Now, 15 years is a staggering difference. It's much larger than the difference between the U.S. and many poor developing countries. So effectively, what we have within the U.S. is we have multiple countries, some of which are developed economies and some of which are poor developing economies. And what's interesting and what's staggering is that this difference in health is not going away. In fact, it's increasing over time. It wasn't all that large in the 1980s and has been growing for three decades now, mostly driven by the growing differences in schooling levels and income levels between communities.
And just, again, to sort of to round us out here, we're coming down to last maybe 3 minutes, three, four minutes. Again, to talk about these trends that you have identified, and as you said, if you go back a few decades, not a long way, but you could go back and you could take some of our case study cities like Austin and Flint, and I hate to keep beating on Flint, but Austin and Flint, you would say that in many ways, how people were doing in those cities, life in those cities, was not that much different. But now there's an enormous difference between Flint and Austin. And your argument here is that this is a trend you expect to continue, and that this kind of divergence between the Austins of the United States and the Flints is going to continue? Is the gap going to continue to widen?
I think so. I see no reason why the economic forces that have been driving this gap, the magnetic attraction of clusters and the sorting of the U.S. population across communities, I don't see any reason why these forces are going to slow down. If anything, my fear is that they're going to actually accelerate, and that the divergence will actually becoming even more pronounced in the coming decades.
Mm. We're in the midst of, or we're going to have a presidential election here, and there's every reason to believe that the economy and job creation, those are going to be key issues. So people are going to be talking about what government can or can't do. Is there here, do you think, a role for the government, for the federal government, in helping to encourage the kind of growth and, say, help more places around the country to be, say, you know, more like Silicon Valley and perhaps less like things are today in Detroit or Cleveland or Flint?
Most of the debate for the presidential election focuses on very short-run changes. So for good reason, people are really concerned about trying to create jobs now,
sure.
Like next
sure.
month or next year. And sure. That's what most of the public debate is about. Unfortunately, that's also the part where the government has the least ability to change things. I think the federal government does have the power to help steer the economy, but not like month to month, not year to year. In the medium long run, yes, there is a number of things that we as a society and as a federal nation, we should do and we could do to try to create more prosperity and more jobs. I don't think they're going to pay off, you know, in 6 months or in 8 months, but they might pay off, like, say, in 5 years, mm-hmm. and then even more so in 10 years. So there are many, many, many things. You asked me about what can be done for struggling communities, and I want to just single out one specific program that has been successful at helping struggling communities. Unlike many other programs that have been attempted that had very mixed results. The program I talk about is called the Empower Women's Zone Program, and it was created in 1993 by the first Clinton administration. And it consisted of targeted incentives for people for businesses to hire workers in distressed urban communities, and incentives for business to invest in those communities, and also neighborhood incentives for neighborhood redevelopment. And recent research shows that the program created jobs and raised local wages, and it's probably a good blueprint of what a federal intervention might look like in the coming years. Mm.
Just real quick, I have an email here from someone who raises an interesting point, who says they've spent time in Berkeley, as well as Urbana and Austin and now Peoria, and they make the argument that says, you know, this area here has great potential, that the right attitude seems to be missing, and the drag of the past seems to be a bit of a problem. Any comments on community attitude and past culture issues?
Sure, that's clearly play as a role. The attitude in a place like here or in Silicon Valley is, well, let's try it. If it doesn't work, no harm done. And so people do try and are free to fail. And when they fail, they get credit for having tried. I think this is a vast difference in attitude relative to places that I know well, like European countries, like Southern European countries. I'm from Italy, and you don't have that attitude. In Italy, failure is a stigma. Here is a sign of, okay, at least you tried. That said, I do think that those attitudes are somehow, they reflect the economic nature. They're both cause and effect of the economic identity of an area. Those attitudes can be changed, and they do change when communities start attracting smart, talented, entrepreneurial individuals that start changing things.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest, Enrico Moretti, is professor of economics at UC Berkeley. His book is The New Geography of Jobs. Professor Moretti, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
On tomorrow's Focus, physicists during World War II, then the Cold War and the space race, were naturally focused on some very practical matters, creating weapons, developing spacecraft, very pragmatic stuff to address concerns of the day. But then some more eccentric types led what came to be known in physics circles as the quantum revival, a sense of discovery, particularly at the subatomic level, returned to physics. Dr. David Kaiser discusses this quantum revival in his book, How the Hippies Saved Physics. We'll hear about it on tomorrow's Focus. That's in the 10 o'clock hour of the program. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, another rebroadcast from the archives, conversation from February of this year with New Yorker staff writer Catherine Boo, author of Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Those are the conversations on Focus tomorrow. It's time for an update on the commodity market, starting with Kansas City wheat for September, trading at 879.5. Make that now 879, down 13.5 in trading today. December wheat at 900.5, that's down 13. September wheat for Chicago at 867.25, down 21. December wheat at 881.5, also down 21 today. September corn trading at 788.75, down 17.75. December corn at 788.25, down 17. March 2013 corn at 786, down 15.25. August soybeans trading at 1669, down 52. September beans at 1617.25, down 39.5. November beans at 1607.25, make that 1608, down 33. August soybean meal trading at 524.60, down 20.10. September soybean meal at 502.50, down 13.20.
August soybean oil at 51.88, down 67 cents. September soybean oil at 52.10, down 68 cents. August live cattle is trading at 119.05. That's up 17.5 cents. October live cattle at 124.35. That's down 5 cents in trading today. August feeder cattle at 140.17.5, up a buck 55. September feeder cattle at